Hello, everyone. This is Steve Phelan for People, Places, and Things, readings from the archives of American Heritage Magazine. And today, we're going to read to you about the dramatic end of the Soviet Union. 22 years ago, and this is a current article, so it really was 22 years ago, the Soviet Parliament suspended the Communist Party after the failure of a dramatic coup attempt to remove Gorbachev. This is by Alexander Burns. In the last days of August, 22 years ago, the Soviet Union imploded. The crash began with an abortive attempt to remove Mikhail Gorbachev from power, and it ended with a parliamentary decision to suspend the activities of the Soviet Communist Party. This last event was perhaps the most extraordinary of all. By a vote of 283-29, with 52 abstentions, the Soviet Parliament shut down the Communist Party founded by Vladimir Lenin and his fellow revolutionaries. Citing party members' roles in the preparation and implementation of the state coup, the government also assumed control of the party's assets and archives. A fatal blow had been struck against the tyrannical institution that had controlled Russia and the other Soviet republics for more than half a century. Margaret Thatcher, who had worked to undermine communist Russia during the previous decade, triumphantly declared, quote, "The forces of dictatorship and communism have been defeated, not only for now, but for a very long time to come." Although the speed of August's events was astonishing even to informed observers, they hadn't come out of nowhere. Throughout Gorbachev's reign, the Soviet bloc had been moving toward more open governmental and economic systems. By the time of the 1991 coup attempt against him, Gorbachev's policies had already produced visible results, most famously the destruction of the Berlin Wall. In the months following that momentous event, the unraveling of the Soviet Union had continued, as numerous Soviet republics, such as Georgia and Ukraine, pressed the central government for a higher degree of autonomy. And, at the beginning of the summer of 1991, a new figure had risen to prominence in Moscow, who would be instrumental in his nation's first final departure from communism. This was Boris Yeltsin, the new president of Russia. One observer would later reflect, "From the moment of Yeltsin's presidential victory, the Communist Party was doomed." But before the Communist Party could be dismantled by Yeltsin and other reformers, its loyalists would strike back viciously. However, their resistance would only give the state they were trying to preserve a shock from which it could not recover. On August 19th, Mikhail Gorbachev was set to sign a treaty further diminishing the power of the Central Soviet government, granting greater independence to the republics. That very day, though, it was announced that he had fallen ill while vacationing in Crimea and would not be returning to Moscow. Instead, Vice President Gennady Yanovev would temporarily take over his responsibilities. This attempt at ousting Gorbachev, disguised as a legal transfer of power, was backed by a cadre within the Soviet government, including the leaders of the KGB, the Defense Ministry, and the Ministry of the Interior. This was an alarming turn of events, creating confusion in the highest circles of one of the most powerful countries in the world. But the coup collapsed almost as quickly as it started. Its principal plotters were a disorganized group, and in later days, the world would learn that some of them, including Yanayev himself, had been drunk throughout significant portions of the coup attempt. The coup's leaders fumbled their plans to use the military to lock down Moscow, and several hours passed before the armed forces could establish an intimidating presence on the streets of major cities. The junta also failed to effectively censor the media, so the illegitimacy of the new government's actions was soon broadcast to the citizens of the USSR. The coup's leaders fumbled their plans Oh, I'm sorry. No, here it is. Most important, the liberalizing forces already in motion began to move with even greater strength and urgency. Provincial commanders rejected or simply disregarded orders from their superiors in the capital. High-profile government officials, including Leningrad's mayor, Anatoly Sobchak, allowed protests to go on unimpeded, and demonstrations spread throughout the Soviet republics. In a stunning act of defiance, Boris Yeltsin led demonstrators in an effort to barricade the parliament, standing in front of and on top of tanks to prevent them from storming the legislature. By August 22nd, less than 4 days after the initiation of the coup, Gorbachev had been restored to power. After his return, the demand for reform was overwhelming. Though Gorbachev had reformist tendencies, he was not willing to accept the death of the Soviet Union. However, in the end, his hesitation was unimportant. Yeltsin, with his steadfast opposition to the coup, had risen to a position of international leadership, and he seized the political opportunity with which he was presented. Within weeks, he installed his allies at the Interior Ministry, the Finance Ministry, and the Central Bank. His friend, Ivan Saleyev, was appointed to lead a task force restructuring the government of the Soviet Empire. Yeltsin had become the unquestioned leader of a vast anti-communist coalition, newly in command of the state and supported not only by ideological liberals but also by nationalist forces and the Russian Orthodox Church. It was in the midst of these events that the Soviet legislature took the step of voting to suspend the operations of the Communist Party. The result of the vote was lopsided, but the number of abstentions and nay votes, totaling 81, was actually the highest of the legislative session. Although the events of the coup virtually required the termination of the Communist Party, there were still elements within the government that hoped to save the organization that had led the October Revolution in 1917. These efforts were destined for failure, however, as individual Soviet republics suspended and disbanded local branches of the Communist Party, effectively cutting off the organization's power and reach. To American observers, these developments were stunning, confusing, and exciting. On the one hand, their nation's longtime adversary, its opponent throughout the Cold War, was finally vanquished. On the other, the world they were living in had suddenly changed forever, and the administration of George H.W. Bush was initially wary of supporting Yeltsin, preferring Gorbachev's comparatively slow approach to reform. But once the unraveling of the Soviet Union had begun, the United States could do little to slow it. On the first day of December, the pivotal Republic of Ukraine voted overwhelmingly for independence from even a loose Soviet coalition. On Christmas, Gorbachev resigned from power, and by New Year's Day, the USSR was no more. The age of mutually assured destruction was over, and a period of uncertainty had begun, a period we are still living in. Okay, let's go to in a completely different direction here with the legend of Mickey Mantle. He was unlike any other baseball star in America, a blonde-haired boy from the heartland whose raw power and mythical purity made him a hero. This is by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith from this past September. History professors Roberts and Smith recently co-authored A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle, from which this essay is adapted. The book traces Mantle's ascendance as an icon of the 1950s and baseball's place in American culture. And here we go. Look at the determination on Mickey Mantle's face, the resolve in his fierce blue eyes, his flexed jaw, and the hardness around his mouth. Look at the power, the prize fighter's cheekbones, the bull's neck, and the hint of a slugger's shoulders. Is this a face of weakness, the look of a man fragile enough to crack into a million pieces? Mantle's chiseled physique looked like the ideal body of a power hitter, a creation of Michelangelo sculpted out of marble. Wonderstruck by his muscled, compact frame, sports writers and teammates tried not to stare when he ambled through the locker room, nearly naked, wearing only a towel, his perfect V-shaped torso, barreled chest, hard stomach, and wide back on display. Built like a lead miner, with broad, sloping shoulders, bulging biceps, and Popeye forearms, Mantle was, in baseball parlance, country strong. Hi Peskin's 1956 Sports Illustrated cover photo reveals the intensity and rugged strength of baseball's most famous player. In that season, branded the Year of the Slugger by the magazine, his career held only great possibilities. Baseball immortality itself was within his reach. His physical gifts, power, speed, and agility, made it seem like there were no limits to what he could do on a baseball field. Yet for all his attributes, Mantle's biographers have emphasized his overriding weakness. Too often, they have presented his life as seen darkly through a rearview mirror, interpreting many events during his baseball career as a way station along the road to alcoholism. Quote, Mickey Mantle's life was spent waiting for a death that seemed just around the corner, biographer David Faulkner wrote. Similarly, in her fine biography, Jane Levy observed, quote, Mantle fit the classical definition of a tragic hero. By the summer of 1995, alcohol-induced cirrhosis of the liver, hepatitis C, and cancer had left him a shell of the man he had been in the 1950s, when, strong and tanned, he had graced the cover of American magazines and thrilled baseball fans on the diamond. Only later would his heavy drinking define the arc of his life. This focus ignores much of the joy of his life, the joy he discovered in the game, and the joy spectators experienced watching him play. To fully understand the man, his impact on baseball, and what he meant to America, it is necessary to look at his life as he lived it, not as a study in retrospection. That means returning Mantle to the 1950s, when he became the most celebrated athlete in the country and reigned as the king of the national pastime. In 1956, only injuries stood between Mickey Mantle and greatness. The Mantle the fans knew, the one they saw at Yankee Stadium, watched on television, and read about in Sports Illustrated, was not a drunk. He was a latter-day legend. In the lore of Mickey Mantle, it is an often-told tale, as well it should be. It is a story of two of the greatest players, and arguably two of the most iconic, of the early post-World War II era, set against the backdrop and excitement and pageantry of a subway series between the New York Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers, at a time when baseball was still the king of all American sports. It is fitting that virtually every book on Mantle pays homage to the play. Before the 1952 World Series, Yankee manager Casey Stengel cornered his young center fielder for a lecture on the wily habits of the Dodger star Jackie Robinson. Jackie, Stengel explained, was the most aggressive base runner in the game. He was known for stretching a single into a double, or blazing around second to turn a double into a triple. In a primal sense, he challenged the manhood of outfielders, calling into question whether they had the talent and nerve to throw him out. Mickey listened, knowing he had the arm, but the nerve, that was another matter. In the eighth inning of Game 3, with the Dodgers leading the Yankees 2-1, Robinson ripped a low-line drive into center field. Charging down the first baseline, he reached full speed in three strides. Rounding first, his spikes kicking dust, he challenged Mantle, who fielded the ball on one hop. Suddenly, the game became a chess match, a test of wits between the young outfielder and an experienced, daring base runner. holding the ball shoulder high, mantle-eyed Robinson, who had slowed to a dance between first and second. Mickey cocked his arm as if he were going to fire it toward first, daring Jackie to make a move. Robinson hesitated, then streaked toward second. Mantle had conned him into running for the extra base, and then threw him out by what seemed like half a city block. When it was over, Jackie smiled and tipped his cap. And Mickey grinned. He had outsmarted the great Jackie Robinson. On the game's greatest stage, Mantle demonstrated that he had the intelligence, instincts, and ability to make, quote, the play. No wonder he recalled it as one of his most treasured memories. No wonder his biographers and a legion of sports writers have fondly recounted the episode. Some consider it one of his greatest World Series plays. As much as his tape measure home runs, it signaled the arrival of Mickey Mantle, the Wonder Boy of the 1950s. It's a marvelous story. There's only one small problem with the tale. It never happened. Mickey did not bait and trap Jackie. Robinson did not attempt to reach second. In fact, he advanced to third base on a single by Roy Campanella and then scored on a hit by Andy Pafko. The Dodgers won the game and took a 2-1 lead in the series. Anyone reading the New York newspapers the next day, on October 4th, 1952, would have seen it recorded that Robinson crossed home plate. The following spring, writing a magazine profile of Mantle, Milton Gross, an eyewitness reporter, noted that after Robinson hit the ball into center field and rounded first base, he stopped, stumbled, got to his feet again, and then scrambled back to first. The significance of, quote, the play is not that it didn't happen, but that it is remembered as if it did. Years later, Mantle confidently recalled throwing out Robinson. "I'll never forget it," he said. Perhaps Mickey confused the play with a similar one in another game. But a close inspection of every Yankees and Dodgers World Series contest that Mantle and Robinson played in 1952, 53, 55, and 56 reveals that Mickey never threw Jackie out at second. It turns out that Mantle was an indifferent student of his own career. In that regard, he was like his teammate, Yogi Berra, who once commented, quote, "I never said most of the things I said." Journalists and biographers have retold Mickey's tale, perpetuating a mythology that started with his own hazy memories. Discerning the truth of Mickey's world, especially during the 1950s, demands casting a skeptical eye on his many ghost-written autobiographies and popular reminiscences of the era. According to the conventional baseball narrative, Mantle played during a more innocent time. After he died in 1995, Sports Illustrated's Richard Hoffer wrote, quote, "Mantle was the last great player on the last great team in the last great country, a post-war civilization that was booming and confident without a trouble in the world." In an introduction to Mantle's memoir of the 1956 season, co-author Phil Pepe wrote of the era that it was, quote, "a wonderful time in this country when everyday life was much less complicated." I'm sorry, wasn't there a nuclear arms race and Joe McCarthy and a few other things? Well, whatever. Yet romanticizing Mantle's place in the, quote, golden age of baseball and the happy days of the 1950s distorts reality. Here we go. Only when we ask how the Cold War and the culture of New York shaped American attitudes toward Mantle can we begin to understand why baseball needed a hero like him. In the making of Mickey Mantle, context was as important as his outsized talent. With the help of the very best sports writers in New York, which was the capital of baseball, he emerged as an American icon. In the decade after World War II, when New York's three major league teams dominated baseball, the city was still very much a newspaper town. The papers connected baseball fans to Mantle throughout the day. Drinking their morning coffee, sports fans read Arthur Daly and Gay Talese at the Times, or Red Smith at the Herald Tribune, the Daily News's Dick Young and the Daily Mirror's Walter Winchell entertained readers on their subway ride to work, and the Post's great columnists, Jimmy Cannon and Milton Gross, absorbed their attention during the ride home, and Frank Graham at the Journal American, or Dan Daniel of the World Telegram and Sun, helped them relax after dinner, offering the latest gossip and baseball news. The most influential New York scribes shaped Mickey's popular image through their writing in Sports Illustrated, Sport, The Sporting News, Baseball Digest, The Saturday Evening Post, Newsweek, Time, and Look. In 1956, Mickey Mantle became baseball's cover boy, publicized and photographed from one coast to another. Yet the writers did more than report feats. They fabricated baseball's myths and produced American heroes. Quote, "Most mythology," David Halberstam wrote, "is manufactured in New York about American virtues. Thus, the mythologists are from New York, but the mythologized are preferably from Commerce, Oklahoma, or in the case of Joe DiMaggio, the son of Italian immigrants, Fisherman's Wharf." If Mickey Mantle had not existed, sports writers and Yankees publicists would have invented him. And in quite a literal sense, they did. They forged the Mickey Mantle Americans adored. Since 1920, sports writers had helped create New York baseball legends. They transformed George Herman Ruth, a loud, boorish man, into the Babe, a jovial idol who loved children, candy, and soda pop as much as he did hitting home runs. They turned a distant, laconic DiMaggio into the incomparable Yankee Clipper, a reserved, classy paragon of excellence. They made Lou Gehrig, the reclusive son of German immigrants, into, quote, the pride of the Yankees, a sentimental favorite who battled a debilitating and ultimately terminal disease with unmatched and unwavering courage. The Yankees and their supporters in the press promoted baseball stars because New Yorkers demanded excellence from the team that embodied the city's competitive values. In 1968, Mantle's final season, historian Bruce Catton recognized as much, writing, quote, "The Yankees perfectly represented what might be called the New York idea, which held that New York had the best of everything. No matter what line of work a man was in, finance, industry, communication, the arts, sports, or fashion, he was not really in unless he was in New York. New York made the pace, it led the way, and everybody else had to follow and like it." Mickey Mantle, the ball player from rural Oklahoma, was next in the assembly line of New York creations. It was all planned from his first glorious spring training camp when he began knocking the ball prodigious distances. That was in 1951, but his anointment was premature. Over the next four seasons, he struggled to fulfill the expectations thrust upon him by the city's hero makers. Instead of a wunderkind, he was an enigma. Fans questioned his character and determination. Then, in 1956, it all came together. After years of disappointments, frustration, and a variety of injuries, in 1956 he confirmed his greatness. It was his best season ever. He performed magnificently, pounding tape-measure home runs into the bleachers of Yankee Stadium, making crucial plays during the World Series, and winning the Triple Crown, a rare achievement that marked his ascendance as the best player in the game. That season, Mantle joined Ty Cobb, Rogers Hornsby, Lou Gehrig, and Ted Williams as the only players that had led both leagues in home runs, batting average, and runs batted in a single season. During their Hall of Fame careers, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Stan Musial, and Willie Mays failed to qualify for this elite club. This short list represents something more significant than the answer to a trivia question. The Triple Crown is at the very heart of baseball's hold on America. A testament of his greatness, Mantle's statistical feat garnered his permanent place in history. More than other sports, baseball, Halberstam observed, depends on statistics because they give meaning to the game's mythology. A player's, quote, performance is not fulfilling enough, he wrote. Quote, it must be shown in quantified heroics, records to be set and broken, new myths and heroes to replace the old. And in 1956, Mantle stepped out of the shadows of Ruth, Gehrig, and DiMaggio. For the first time in his career, the sun-bathed stage of Yankee Stadium truly belonged to him. There may have been a player who had a year close to Mickey Mantle's perfect season, but none had a more euphonious name or better looks, or was so well-suited for the television age. He was unlike any other baseball star in America. The realization of Bernard Malamud's protagonist in The Natural, a blue-eyed, blonde-haired boy from the heartland whose raw power and mythical purity made him a hero. Of course, there were always two Mickey Mantles, the man and his image, and New York's celebrity-making culture shaped and eventually eroded both. Okay, now we're going to start another article here, though we certainly won't have time to finish it. This is The Pioneers, quote, For the Ohio. David McCullough's latest book tells the story of a small group of Revolutionary War veterans and pioneers who set out on an extraordinary 800-mile journey through the wilderness to establish the first settlement in the Ohio Territory. This is by Edwin Grosvenor. The Seneca Indians called it the Ohio, pronounced Ohio, literally the Good River. When French explorer La Salle first saw the Ohio in 1669, he described it as La Belle Rivière, the beautiful river. Thomas Jefferson echoed their sentiments, calling the Ohio, quote, the most beautiful river on earth in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, even though he had never seen it. However, it was described, the Ohio River became the primary means to venture west for early European settlers, allowing them to float through largely roadless forests from Williamsport or Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania to the Mississippi, and then on down to New Orleans and the land of the $10 banknote known as La Dixie. The Ohio River was also an important boundary. To its south lay territory claimed by Virginia, stretching to the Mississippi. The Treaty of Fort Stanwix in 1768 ceded the land to Virginia, and by the 1770s, early settlers were following Daniel Boone into what would later become the state of Kentucky. The land to the north of the Ohio remained largely wilderness, but it continued to be very much on the mind of many American colonists. In 1774, the British Parliament voided their claims to the territory in the controversial Quebec Act and declared the Ohio Territory part of Quebec. The resulting anger among the Americans after they had fought a succession of bitter wars against the French-speaking Catholics in Canada was one of the factors pushing them to revolt against the king a few years later. In his new book, The Pioneers, David McCullough tells of the extraordinary story of the first settlements in the vast wilderness of the Northwest Territory. McCullough got his start in 1964 as an editor and writer for American Heritage, his, quote, graduate school, as he called it. Quote, once I discovered the endless fascination of doing the research and the writing, I knew I had found what I wanted to do with my life, he says. And we are delighted that over the years he has done such an admirable job of continuing in, quote, the American heritage style. And that's where we're going to wrap it up for today. We'll continue this story next week. But for the moment, this is Steve Phelan saying goodbye, everyone, for American Heritage and People, Places, and Things.